Hi, you're listening live to the 14th episode of the Armand and Akhil Show, bringing you interviews with local activists, politicians, and policy experts from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. I'm Akhil Krishnan.
And I'm Armand Rana. It's Saturday, the 18th of May, 2024, at 5.03 p.m. We are broadcasting live from UBC's Vancouver campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hankamina-speaking Musqueam people.
How's it going, Armand?
Not bad. Yeah, it's a somewhat sunny day, so pretty good. Yeah,
kind of like a full summer feeling, though. Hey,
You know, we had some warm
days. We had some warm days, but this is the typical Vancouver spring story of not really consistent weather.
Yeah. Like summer started. I think I announced summer like last show.
Yes,
and then it just like rained the next week.
I was very skeptical the moment you proclaimed the summer was here. I didn't want to believe it, and I was right.
Seems you were right, yeah.
So since the last time that we were on the air, you went to Seattle, is that right?
Yeah. I was
what'd you
Portland.
Get up to there?
I was
Portland.
Portland. Yeah, yeah.
Pretty far south.
I was sick, so I spent time with family, spent time with a friend. I went to the zoo.
In Portland or Seattle?
In Portland. So saw an elephant for the first time in like 10 years, so it's pretty interesting. They seemed kind of sad, but. It was interesting.
Well, they weren't as happy as the elephants you probably saw in South Africa or in India in their natural habitat doing their own thing.
But I also read this book called What is America? It's pretty interesting. It's by, I think his name is Ronald Wright. What is America? I'm just looking this up. What is America? I think he's a UBC prof.
Okay.
And yeah, Ronald Wright. It's about 10 years old, the book. But yeah, it's pretty interesting. It talks a lot about the indigenous people of the United States and the narratives that the Western people had when they colonized, that part of the world, and how those narratives continue to drive American foreign policy at large. He drew a lot of interesting parallels with, Vietnam or, all sorts of even Iraq War and contemporary conflicts. This book was written 10, 15 years ago.
I was just going to ask when it was published. Yeah.
It's really interesting. I haven't finished it yet, but it was nice reading that and just the land of the free.
How did you get introduced to the book? What precipitated you reading it?
The previous book by this author, actually, I read was A Short History of Progress, and I think I probably heard of that on a podcast or something.
Okay.
But that's also a really good book. Highly recommend. I gave it to my sister for her birthday. Don't know if she read it.
You haven't broached the topic since then?
No. But if she doesn't read it, I'll just take it. I don't have a copy of my own, so I'll just take
Sometimes
it. I don't mind rereading it.
Reclaim your copy.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, how have you been?
I've been good. I've been busy with work. Besides that, I've just been, actually been reading something completely different.
Like something from Monty Python?
No, I think actually what I've been reading is entertaining, not quite in the same way, though. I've been reading a lot about...
So it's not completely different, then?
It's... hear this and tell me how different it is in what you're reading. I've been reading about the Punic Wars.
Oh, you were telling me about it. What is the Punic Wars? It sounds very... I don't know.
So the Punic Wars...
Puny. A puny significance.
So the Punic Wars were conflicts in the Mediterranean that were fought over a period of about 250 years from about like 300.
Was it the one between the Carthaginians and the...
And the Romans.
And the Romans, yeah.
Yes.
So it's like modern-day Tunisians.
Exactly, yeah. So that's pretty much where Carthage was. And it was basically a series of three conflicts on land in Sicily. The first one, the second one was in what was Iberia then, today's Spain, and then over in mainland Italy itself with the Roman Empire, the heart of the Roman Empire itself. And then the third one was pretty much right at Carthage and resulted in Carthage being burned down. Spoiler alert. I've been captivated by that period of history, and I've been reading a lot about it. I had a phase where I was reading just Alexander the Great.
So what interests you about that period of history?
Just how pivotal those wars were in kind of determining what the modern world looks like. Yeah. Because it was a nascent Roman Empire that wasn't yet the all-powerful entity that we now know and regard.
I see.
If the Carthaginians had won, our world would look very different. Yeah. So they were far less militaristic than the Romans were. They were a lot more just merchant
Maybe that's how they lost the war with the Romans.
Well, actually,
there could be some correlation.
You make a great point because they definitely did not want to support the war effort at times because they're like, this is the bottom line doesn't quite work out. They really did sound like C-suite executives. It was just like, I don't know, the prophet's really justified losses here. Like he's just doing something out there. But anyway, I'm really captivated by how different the world will look if a mercantile empire like the Carthaginians had actually won. And how different the world would be.
So they're basically like a combination of like anti-war hippies with like CC executives.
Yes, but exclusively with an eye to keeping the wealth intact.
Okay, interesting combo.
And there's also
that world would be very different.
But there's also undercurrent. Like personal undercurrent, which I love, right? Of how the family that kind of led all three wars or like had a big part to play in all three wars, the Barca family, how they weren't particularly liked, and so the kind of the personal familial and dynastic struggles almost, I think would make for a great TV show. Someone should get on that ASAP.
I see, interesting, like Succession kind of vibes.
Actually, yeah, but over the period of like 250 years, and resulted in their entire civilization being completely scorched to the earth. But that's what I've been reading. And on the other hand, the other book I've been reading is on human loneliness in the modern world.
I see.
So, a little bit of some varied reading material for me.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I hope you're not lonely right now on this radio show.
With two people in the studio? I think it's too few people.
Yeah, just need...
We should get a couple more people in here. Maybe an elephant, too.
An elephant, yeah. From the Oregon Zoo.
So tell us a little bit about what the plan is today.
I don't know what the plan is, but I got this first clip that I wanted to kind of cold open with. So let's kick it off with that.
Do you want to give any introduction to this?
Just go right into it. Like people have no clue who the guy is, why he's saying, and then I'll explain later.
All right. Let's see how well informed our listeners are.
Let's not kid ourselves. In a situation of injustice and oppression, there can be no neutrality. You have to take sides. You have to say, am I on the side of justice or am I on the side of injustice? When an elephant is sitting on the tail of a mouse, and you say, I am neutral, the mouse is not going to be particularly pleased about your neutrality. You have already made a decision. You have decided to be on the side of the powerful, of the elephant. There is no neutrality. They talk about reforming apartheid. We are not interested in reforming apartheid. You don't reform a Frankenstein, you destroy a Frankenstein. But we want a new South Africa for all of its people, black and white. We want a South Africa where people count, not because of biological irrelevancies, the color of their skin or any other thing, where people count because of who they are, persons of infinite worth because they are created in the image of God. We want a new South Africa that is democratic, truly democratic. We want a South Africa that is truly just.
So who is that? We went completely cold into that. Who is this unknown gentleman speaking on an unknown university?
Yeah, well, you gave the game away. Speaking of, he was speaking. This is Desmond Tutu, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, the late Archbishop Desmond Tutu, speaking in 1986 at Stanford University, and he was one of the instrumental figures in the anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa. He led the, he helped kind of bring the different competing liberation factions together to kind of negotiate with the apartheid government. And he also oversaw the Truth and Reconciliation Committee. So after the end of apartheid, compared to, like, you know, in Nazi Germany, the Allies, all the war criminals and stuff, they, you know, tried them and executed some of them, right? In South Africa, they had a completely different process called Truth and Reconciliation Committee, where the people who committed all these terrible crimes, they just said what crimes they did, and they asked for forgiveness, and some of them didn't even ask for forgiveness, and no crimes committed as actions of the apartheid government were ever prosecuted in South Africa. And he was one who led that process to try and bring healing to the families, at least get the truth out of why their children died or killed or kidnapped or all sorts of horrible things that took place. He was always like a moral icon in South Africa.
And this was with an eye to create to almost as quickly as possible transition into a stable society without a civil war or
exactly right, and yeah, also, you know, ingratiate themselves with, you know, the Western world as well,
right?
You're right, and yeah, exactly, without descending into, because it, South Africa is actually, you know, people today talk about you know, Israel Palestine's population together, the combined region, about 12 million plus minus, right?
Yes.
Is that accurate?
Yeah. It's in the ballpark. Yeah.
South Africa's population around 50 million.
Yeah.
And it has a lot of different tribes, each with their, you know, and communities, and each with their own histories.
For sure.
The Afrikaners, the English, the Zulus, the Xhosa, and they go 13 official languages.
Sure.
So it's just a geographical block.
Yeah.
That was colonized by the British and decided to continue to exist together as one nation. But there isn't any unity of language or, common religious or kind of linguistic or tribal affiliation that they belong to.
And the end of apartheid wasn't quite, it's not exactly like an independence day, right, from an external power. It's more of a transition.
Yeah.
But probably one of the most peaceful watershed moments in any country's history. If you look at any other, most other countries that either, you know, had independence movements, independence was typically marked with some level of large-scale
There was violence leading up to the end of apartheid. There was a lot of violence, don't get me wrong. But once the transition took place, it was probably the best possible outcome, right, in terms of the level of peace that existed. Yeah, totally. Yeah.
And stability, right?
Yeah, stability, yeah. Right, and some degree of continuity of, you know, government actually functioning and just not descending into civil war, which is what we see in most of the world. Hey, what was your reaction or feeling when you were listening to that?
He's a very powerful speaker, and obviously knowing, you know, I want to put myself in the shoes of somebody who's listening to him back in 1986, back then, there was obviously a huge tide against apartheid, the apartheid government already. But he makes he's an excellent speaker, and he really brings out a lot of emotion in how he put the point, right? That it's true. Like, you can't say that I'm neutral, and when an elephant is sitting on a mouse's tail, and claim that that's neutrality, and that's, you know, so, like, you see both sides of the story.
Yeah.
That there's no, that you might see that as an absolute statement of it's not my business, but human rights is everyone's business.
I guess that's
so on the topic of transitions to stability and democracies, we have an election in this province.
That was a hard, hard transition.
I was waiting for you to
That was a violent transition.
That was
end of apartheid was peaceful, but that was a violent transition. Okay, so BC.
This was a
BC
180 by an 18-wheeler going 120 kilometers per hour on the Transcontinental Highway. Yes. So we have elections in this province in about, I want to say, 5 months now. Hey.
Yeah.
Yeah. At the end of October, I think we can expect a writ, the writ to be dropped, so election period to formally start at the end of September, which is what it did last time around. So we'll have an election of about a month election period of a month, and then of course election day at the end of October. So for our listeners, there are four major parties running in this election: the governing BC NDP, the opposition BC United, and then the third parties, the BC Green Party, and the new up-and-comer, the BC Conservatives.
Yeah, yeah.
And we have spoken on the show about this election before and about the parties and broadly about just the story behind how the BC Conservatives pipped the current opposition party, the BC United, to get to second place in the polls.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And now it's like very apparent, like the latest polls, they're like practically in a virtual statistical tie.
Absolutely.
With the BC NDP, which is insane, right? Like 6 months ago, even 2 months ago, I said there's no way the BC NDP are going to lose this election. And now it seems quite possible and potentially likely that the BC NDP could lose this election. And we have a theory as to what is driving conservative support. What is your theory? You were talking about it before the show. In terms of, like, you know, you're saying that people are, like, Kevin Falcon made a comment that, what was the comment?
That people are, basically, Kevin Falcon, for context, is the leader of the BC United Party, which is a conservative party, which is the current opposition in the BC legislature. He made a comment that the reason the BC Conservatives are now second in the polls was because of a conflation brand issue. And he basically said it's because they think they're voting for a party that's affiliated with the federal conservatives. So yeah, we're getting support that would be going to the federal conservatives. It's kind of seeping into the provincial election. And initially, I think I dismissed it and I said, well, there's a very public feud that you had with this member, John Rustad, who was kicked out of BC United because of his views on climate change, who went on to become the leader of the BC Conservatives.
And it was very specific. It was climate change denial. Like,
exactly.
He was saying that he's skeptical that human carbon emissions are causing climate change.
Exactly. His point was essentially that we're small. How much damage? How can we change the climate, right? But BC United leader Kevin Falcon continued to say that, you know, it's just a conflation issue. It's just that people think they're voting for the federal conservatives in the provincial elections. And he doesn't believe. I'm coming around to that point. I think that's true. I think that is exactly what's happening. Because you kind of see as you know, Polyev surges in the polls, sort of the BC Conservatives, right?
Yeah.
And there's kind of, it's not lockstep, but there is some correlation there. And it's hard to disconnect the two. Your name is almost identical.
Yeah, yeah. But I think definitely, like, ideology, it's not exactly the same package that you're buying. Like, I think John Rustad, at least historically, has lent more into a lot of the social conservative issues.
Absolutely.
Than even Pierre Polyev, who is maybe on the right of the social conservatism off the federal party. But
he's very careful to kind of pussyfoot around those issues because he knows that getting into the weeds on those issues isn't a winning strategy.
Or he believes it. But for John Rustad, it seems to be doing okay for him. Because, he, you know, had those interesting views on climate change. You know, I think it's worthwhile to just, like, take a look at the platforms. There's some pretty interesting stuff.
I think this is something that we read previously. So the big issues in this election are obviously cost of living, economic outlook, housing prices, and I think the climate is a big one too, because this since the BC and the NDP have come into 2017, there's been a lot of movement on the climate front. Clean BC is a huge program that's the cornerstone of the BC NDP.
And just for full disclosure, Akhil is like a fully paid up apparatchik of the BC NDP.
I would take exception with that characterization. I'm a volunteer for the BC NDP. I do serve as the treasurer. Yeah, for full disclosure, I do serve as the treasurer on the Vancouver Little Mountain Constituency Association.
Yeah. Okay. Sorry for mischaracterizing your affiliation there. But yeah. So yeah. I think and it's interesting. I think what's interesting to me, as a non-apparatchik, is when I look at the Conservative Party platform, they're like energy and the environment. And the three policies are scrap the tax, carbon tax, expand LNG, and get pipelines built. And maybe there's some, like, you know, multi-level, multi-dimensional chess here. But, like, just at face value, as if you are an environment conscious voter, those are not issues or programs that you would associate with improving the environment. Yeah, it's just an interesting choice there. And then the other one that kind of jumps out to me is, in terms of schooling, this whole stuff about, independent schooling, support parents' choices, the government should fund, this includes public, private, or homeschooling. BC is one of the, I think, the only places or one of the few places in Canada where the government actually pays for private schools, and it's often religious schools. And for me, as a person who's not like super into the idea, I like learning about religion. I think everyone should learn about all religions. It's great. I'm not super in the idea of like the government funding a particular you to learn about a particular religion. It seems a slippery slope.
The idea of religious schools existing is not in question here, right? They do have every right to exist. And if parents feel like their children need, Bible Sundays and they need, Bible study in recess, that's fine. That's their prerogative.
Religious freedom, yeah.
Exactly, religious freedom, right? It's one of the hallmarks of a free society.
Yeah.
But the fact that taxpayer money is used to fund that is a slippery slope. The government supporting these schools can just be saying that we're protecting a right to exist and we're ensuring that there's no threats to your school from other religious groups or non-religious people, but not that we're going to fund students to attend these schools. And the number is not small. Of course, there are two main categories. The religious schools by far are the big
recipients.
The second one are government elite.
At present, without even Judge Rostad in power.
Exactly.
Right?
At present. And the second is, just to mention for completeness, there is a second set, and there are private elite prep schools that do receive funding from this pool. The number was like $491 million last year or a couple of years ago. Not at all a small chump.
And just to be clear, the Conservative Party wants to significantly expand that.
Exactly.
I think it's, it is interesting. This is just completely us skimming the platform. I think we do want to have, candidates on. We actually were supposed to have John Russell on at some point in time. Hopefully as the election gets a bit closer, we'll do a more in-depth analysis here. Any thoughts that jumped out to you as you're perusing?
What did you call me?
I didn't want to call you apparatchik again. I thought, I've not called you apparatchik twice. It's just...
I think the other one that jumped out to me was obviously remove ideology from the classroom, and that to me like is a veiled attempt. That and also support parents' choices. Of course, support parents' choices. The subtext there is it says that private schools, religious schools should be allowed, but the underlying message here is that it's opposed to SOGI education, right? Sexual orientation, gender identity. Education, it is an issue in this election. John Rustad made it an issue, right?
Yeah.
It was an issue before. There were parents who were concerned, but then now it's become a much bigger issue than it was previously. The previous election was all about cost of living, COVID lockdowns, home ownership, and now this one's also sprung up. And I'm surprised by how much discussion there is around social issues in a province like British Columbia today.
Yeah, it is interesting. And I think what's interesting to me is actually we used to have like sex ed and all these things in the classroom. And in fact, when I was looking at SOGI, most of it actually isn't very different than what I was taught 10, 15 years ago.
Yeah.
I think what parents actually have a problem with is their kids' perception and values have changed. The education has stayed more or less the same. But the kids themselves, their perception and their values, and it's, I think a lot of it is about, through the internet, through different things, both in good and bad ways, their values have changed and they're not necessarily in lockstep with their parents. And I think that's, they're trying to make the school, from my perspective with the SOGI stuff, they're trying to make the school like, they're holding responsible for like making my kid not believe in, strict gender roles. But I think that's kind of... not what the school is like. Most kids just do math at school, and I think that's pretty mundane stuff.
Yeah,
it's not this freaky stuff that people think.
And in general, like the education is just more like awareness creating, right? Is that look, there's like, you know, these are the most common sexual orientations.
I was taught that like 15, 20 years ago as well. Like,
that's what I mean. So that hasn't changed, right? Yeah. So even if you did take it out of schools, there's the internet.
Yeah, yeah. Jumping to the BC NDP's website. So this one, I have to say, I have no clue what's going on with you. So I go to BC NDP. It says, David Eby and the BC NDP are working for you. I click on the menu bar. It says, team events, latest, become a member. Nothing about platform.
You'd have to scroll down for the
platform. I scroll down. It says, it has a big picture of David Eby with a kid on his shoulders. And he's like, British Columbians are facing big challenges. David Eby has our back. I'm scrolling down and it says, David Eby is looking out for you and your family. And then it's got these dates and like various stronger BC, read the speech from the throne. So I honestly don't know what the platform is. Like, I get that David Eby is a G guy. But that's all I get from this. Like, David Eby is great. He likes kids, which is good. And I actually can't find the platform here. So I think that's something that I know it's not your purview as treasurer, but you need to allocate some funding to putting a platform on your website. And then, you know what I did actually? So I was so desperate. I went into Google and I searched, you know, BC NDP. And there in the sublinks under Google, in the Google search results, there is a link to the BC NDP website and it says our plan's guiding principles. So I was excited. I was like, I finally found the link. And it's going, at some point it says, John Horgan and the NDP will continue working to make life affordable for everyone. So this is from 5 years ago. So, yeah.
John Horgan might be the ambassador, the Canadian ambassador to Germany, but that does not mean he is not focused on making everyone's lives better.
Yeah. Yeah, this is embarrassing. Anyway, so you guys need to, I think, up your game. I won't ask you to comment on your...
Well, I'm not a spokesperson for the BC NDP, yeah, right? And I can't assume that role. But I do know that there is more of a platform when you go under latest, and it's in the form of articles on the different issues. So as someone who works in tech, you clearly have some design critiques for the website. And it also sounds like my assignment now is to take this back to HQ.
Anyway, let's move on.
I want to say about this is also that, on the Conservatives website, and I think this is something that's been an issue in BC for a while, is ICBC. And the BC Conservatives, so in British Columbia, we have a Crown corporation that does all auto insurance in the province. And Alberta, Ontario, they have different models. They have a private models where you have private companies competing, offering rates, as you would in any kind of market. ICBC has been called ineffectual, bloated, monopolistic. Yeah. And not all of that sound true, but one of the things the Conservatives want to do, and I think BC United would like to do as well, is kind of move to a private-public kind of system. Seeing how it works in Alberta and Ontario, I'm not exactly enthused by that idea because their rates are competitive in some cases, if not worse, than what we pay here.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting. We had pretty high, I think, rates prior to the switch to no-fault insurance.
Exactly, yeah.
So,
it was shocking because before no fault insurance, ICBC was a rare case of an insurance company losing money.
Yeah,
and it lost $1 billion in 2019, I believe it was.
Yeah, and a lot of the structural issues with it, I remember when I first came here were actually created under the time of Premier Christy Clark, with ICBC, where I think the way she balanced the budget was by taking money from ICBC. I can't remember the details. I need to look it up. I don't want to mischaracterize her actions at the time, but it was something of dubious financial quality. In any case, the other last thing I want to point out, you know, about this polling is that we're seeing that John Rustad is doing pretty well amongst, you know, two demographics. Surprisingly, he's doing pretty well. Like, his highest favorables, is amongst young people and men, which is surprising because generally conservatives, and actually Premier Eby's highest favorables amongst those who are 55 plus. He's doing actually pretty well with young people too. He's having difficulty for something with Gen X, which we were
with his generation,
with his own generation, which is funny. So it is interesting. I think there is an interesting trend. What you're seeing is that young men are actually becoming a lot more socially conservative than millennials. Like Gen Z is in some ways is becoming socially conservative increasingly, and maybe younger millennials too. That's an interesting trend. And I think that's kind of part of what we're seeing here as well.
Any closing thoughts about the BC election? Just to provide in some numbers, I guess. The polling has tightened by about like 10-15%. The BC NDP were expected to get more than 50% of the vote a few months ago. The polling is now tightened to close to 40%. And they're within 5 to 10 percentage points of the... They're within about 10 percentage points of the BC Conservatives.
Yeah. There's some polls, individual polls, where they're tied.
Yeah, this is an aggregated poll.
I think the main thing I would suggest is people actually read the platforms of the provincial party, not the federal party, but read the actual platforms of the provincial party.
Absolutely.
And understand the package deal, you know, who these characters are. In a place, in a parliamentary system like BC, the premier actually has a lot of power in terms of the direction of the province. Yeah. Once you're premier, they pretty much, you know, it isn't that consensus building. They kind of drive the direction.
And especially if you have a majority, right?
Exactly.
You told the party line. They will whip the votes and it will things will get passed.
You understand, you know, who is Premier Eby, who is John Rastatt, you know, what their values are. Do they align with yours? I think that's an important exercise people need to do. That's my main thing I would suggest.
Absolutely. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to the Armand and Akhil show on CITR 101.9 FM. We were just discussing the end of apartheid and the BC elections that are going to come up in the next 5 months. Stick around. We've got a lot more to come. We're going to go around the globe in the segment right after this break.
3, 2, 1. Eastman, we have liftoff.
Ignite Youth Arts Festival brings a week of youth-run programming to the Kulch's Historic Theater from May 13th to 18th. Featuring theater performers, filmmakers, musicians, poets, drag artists, visual artists, multidisciplinary artists, and more. Each of the main festival nights offer a diverse spread of performances in a variety show style. This year, Ignite is going spatial to celebrate the voices of rising stars. Get your ticket now at thekulch.com. or through the Kulch's box office at 604-251-1363.
This is Kristen Carter. My debut contemporary pop album, Full Bloom, is now yours to discover. Full Bloom is a living garden of 12 songs that celebrates the beauty and the seasonal nature of life. You can find Full Bloom wherever you listen to music. Visit thekristencarter.com or follow at Kristen Carter Music for more. Funded by Factor and Canada's private radio broadcasters. I just wanna feel alive.
Take a moment, do some more than just survive. You can't choose the same, left to cry. The annual Sled Island Music and Arts Festival is back June 19th to 23rd. Experience 5 days of music, comedy, film, and art in diverse venues across Calgary, Alberta. Featuring New York experimental hardcore trio Show Me the Body as guest curator, incisive Chicago rapper Mick Jenkins, Los Angeles indie rockers Cherry Glazer, Canadian indie rock sensation Ecstasy, genre-bending rap artist Carrie Faux, Montreal-based hip-hop trio Planet Giza, 70s Zamrock revivalist with trailblazing Argentine singer-songwriter Juana Molina, and many, many more. Plus, there's over 150 more artists in the full lineup. Check out the full lineup and get your passes and tickets at sledisland.com. Repeat, sledisland.com.
Welcome, neighbor, to our neighborhood. In Our Gayborhood is a journey through the communities of BC, meeting our neighbors who work towards a world where everyone can be proud of who they are. In our first season, get to know the Touche L'Ojibwetikwa advocates, educators, and students who help our schools grow into spaces where everyone can belong. Just like our neighborhoods, each episode is filled with the spirit of care, the energy of activism, and the warmth of community. Join us in our neighborhood, premiering June 14th at the Queer Arts Festival.
The annual Sled Island Music and Arts Festival is back June 19th to 23rd. Experience 5 days of music, comedy, film, and art in diverse venues across Calgary, Alberta. Featuring New York experimental hardcore trio Show Me the Body as guest curator, incisive Chicago rapper Mick Jenkins, Los Angeles indie rockers Cherry Glazer, genre-bending rap artist Carrie Foe, Montreal-based hip-hop trio Planet Giza, 70s Zamrock revivalists Witch, renowned soundscape composer Laurel Halo, British electronic producer Forest Swords, eminent post-punk three-piece Wombo, Philadelphia hardcore punk group Soul Glow, and many more. Plus, there's over 150 more artists still to be announced. Check out the current lineup and get your passes and tickets at sledisland.com.
Welcome back. You're listening live to the Armand and Nikhil Show, where we are discussing issues from across the world. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM. Armand, take it away.
Take quite a bit. So we're talking about, the encampments now, I guess. So the, should I read the UBC statement? Or?
Yeah, so just to provide some context for our listeners, as you may or may not have seen, there are encampments in support in protesting the war in Gaza that have sprung up across university campuses in North America broadly, in the United States, but also at home here in Canada. We've seen encampments in University of Alberta, University of Calgary, McGill, and even at home here in UBC. And we just want to quickly touch on the encampments and so the university's response to them and what the courts have had to say.
Yeah, so there's one right across from where I live, and it's actually it's on the field where I jog quite often. And we were hoping to have somebody on from the encampment to speak, but maybe next time. I guess, so the UBC president, I believe, the statement's from the president, Benoit Anton Bacon, issued a statement. I'll just read the first paragraph, I guess. Dear members, so basically the goal of, all of these statements is to avoid offending anybody.
Like, yes.
That's basically the goal of these statements, is like, try and say a lot of stuff without saying anything offending. It's like exactly the opposite of Desmond Tutu's speech at the beginning.
Yeah.
This is like...
You want to pacify everybody, right?
Yeah.
And you don't want to step on anyone's toes. You don't want to alienate anyone. And you basically want to... it's a diplomatic, everybody please like me.
Yeah, exactly. So it goes, dear members of the UBC community, the violence unfolding in Israel and Palestine continues to evoke complex emotions around the world. And many in our diverse community are deeply affected. The grief and suffering we all witness and feel is heartbreaking. As you are aware, about a week ago, a protest began at McGuinness Field on the Vancouver campus and is ongoing. There are currently about 75 tents and 100 people at the site. This protest is part of a broader movement that started in the United States and is now spread to Canada. Students are looking at a world in crisis, and at their core, the campus protests are seeking the end of violence in Israel and Palestine. UBC deeply values freedom of expression and respects its corollary of peaceful protests. We're actively monitoring the situation and prioritizing the safety of all our community members and visitors to campus. We have made clear the university's expectations of the protesters at McGuinness Field. I want to stress again that protest actions must be conducted with respect for others and within the boundaries of UBC policy and the law, and any action that contravenes this will be taken very seriously. It goes on to say... So
this statement, what you've read so far is exactly what you said, right? It does touch on the right to expression. It says, we do respect that, and that you have a right to be heard. And that is quite different than some of the responses we've seen across the country, where on McGill's campus, there is an encampment, and the university has repeatedly tried to get an injunction against the encampment to have it removed from campus. The second encampment was injunction request was actually just denied by the Quebec Superior Court judge, Marc St-Pierre, who said that the university failed to justify, and I'm quoting here, the quote, the university failed to justify the urgent need to dismantle the camp, unquote. And the McGill again filed another injunction request, and they said that the encampment was unsafe, posing a risk to escalating tensions and preventing McGill from holding his convocation ceremonies at its outdoor location, unquote. And the judge went on to dismiss those as well. And so basically the bottom line is the judge, in this case of the Quebec Superior Court, failed to see the university's point, and he basically said they had no case.
Yeah, which is interesting. I think, the other thing which is mentioned here is that he also, this letter all goes on to say, one issue that's been raised across North America is the call for divestments. At UBC, the endowment fund does not directly own any stock in the companies identified the movement. Capital is held in pooled funds and managed by external investment managers, with identified companies accounting for about 0.2% of the endowment fund. So, yeah, I guess it is interesting how the conversation has changed, even in terms of BDS, in terms of, like, they actually are doing the calculation and seeing what percentage of them are invested in companies that are considered,
right,
whatever their criteria is, you know, for, you know, somehow assisting in the occupation of Palestine. So it is interesting how the conversation has changed in that regard. But yeah, I think that the thing that, you know, as you mentioned, which is the thing that's standing out to me right now is, first of all, that this is legal. That, exactly. I think a lot of people, this has gone to the Supreme Court. It is legal. What they're doing is legal. Like, yeah, if they go and beat somebody up, that won't be legal. But just the act of setting up an encampment in the way they're doing, that itself is not illegal. And the other thing is that the language he's using here, where he says, you know, complex emotions, you know, diverse community, you know, this extremely vague language is just so transparently trying to avoid being specific.
Exactly. Avoid taking a position, right?
Yeah.
Which is something that the people on both sides want, yeah, is for people to, for people in authority to take a position, right?
Yeah.
And just on this topic, what we wanted to look at was, what is the legal community's opinion on the legality of encampments, right? And what does, and how does,
and
it relate,
specifically in Canada?
In Canada, specifically, and how does it relate to your freedom of expression that is charter protected? And just a couple of court cases that go to the heart of this, and I'm reading here from the Alberta Civil Liberties Research Center, and some actually both, and I want to use this word carefully, both, I don't want to say violent, but say forceful dismantling and clearing of protesters have happened at the University of Alberta and the University of Calgary. And so there was a court case, the Batty versus the City of Toronto, where the justice in the case, actually, let's first go to the Federal Court of Appeal, where there was a court case, Weisfeld v. Canada, that basically said expression goes beyond words. So people may choose to amplify or dramatize their messages in many ways, sandwich board, a soapbox, a megaphone, a flag, a banner, a placard, a picture, a petition, unquote. Basically saying that you can't make the argument that it's just speech and that it goes well beyond that. And then we get to the second one, which is Batty versus City of Toronto, where Justice Brown, adopting the reasoning held in Weisfeld, held that the structures and tents erected by the protesters in a public park constituted a mode of expression protected by Section 2 of the Charter. And finally, there was the Alberta Superior Court, which held that universities seeking to remove encampments from their campuses constituted government action. So when you tie all of these three together, it basically becomes a protected
action.
A protected action.
Yeah.
Right. Basically, because, you know, you say that if it's on a public park, then it's, you know, which any attempt to remove that would be governmental action. And then if they're basically saying that if you're removing, if the university tries to claim that university property is private property owned by the university organization, therefore you need to leave, that is governmental action, and it's yeah. It's a charter. It becomes a question of charter rights.
Yeah. I think the other thing that we found funny, I think this was on a UBC Reddit messenger board where some people were complaining about the protesters and the encampments, and they were saying, you know, in Canada we don't have freedom of speech, we have freedom of expression,
which is slightly different, but you should know that. Yeah.
But like, yeah,
freedom of expression actually broader.
Yeah, it depends. But like, if yeah, it's often used interchangeably for our purposes. It's pretty much the same thing in this context. Yes, in theory freedom of speech can be broader, you know, because it's not just verbal. But even in the United States, freedom of speech, where they have freedom of speech, is interpreted as freedom of expression. Like, you can do other things beyond speaking.
The best example of this is the legality of
Citizens United.
Of obscene material.
Yeah.
Now, I'm going to say the obscene material, right?
Or even which Citizens is freedom of speech. Citizens United, which you can corrupt politicians in the United States, which is considered freedom of speech.
Yes.
Right? Which is not a great law. Just for clarity, Citizens United was a court case.
A Supreme Court case,
which basically allowed people to donate unlimited amounts of money for the promotion of a particular candidate in a political race.
Exactly.
Because it was considered.
So the distinction there is you cannot donate directly to the candidate, but you can donate to these so-called PACs, political action committees, that can spend untold amounts of money on any campaign.
Yeah.
Which is basically saying that money is a form of expression.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is ludicrous, but that's a discussion for another day.
Yeah.
Well, while we're talking about America and American things and identities, intersectionality, there's a clip here that I wanted to play from the U.S. As regards to the Republican primary races.
Which are over now.
Which are over now.
Trump is the nominee.
Exactly. But you're going to hear in this clip Ann Coulter, who is a Republican commentator, talking to Vivek Ramaswamy, who was a candidate for the Republican presidential, who was a candidate in the Republican primary, who dropped out. Let's take a listen to their exchange.
You are so bright and articulate, and I guess I can call you articulate since you're not an American black. Oh, and I agreed with many, many things you said during, in fact, probably more than most other candidates when you were running for president, but I still would not have voted for you because you're an Indian. You know.
So, Ramon, what did you think about that?
Yeah, it's amazing. Can you give just we've talked about Vivek Ramaswamy in the past. You know, he's like your brother in from the Tamil speaking part of India. But, you know, he has interesting views on citizenship and, you know, very strange perspectives in general. Like, he wanted people to go to the army or something to get citizenship. But
also he said that he would deport all illegal immigrants within time frame of him becoming president.
But give our listeners a bit more background on Ann Coulter. Like, who is she?
So Ann Coulter, I'm going to refer to the Wikipedia page here just for a little bit of help on her broad experience at the conservative movement. She's basically a conservative media pundit, author, syndicated columnist, and lawyer. And she's been pretty vocal in like the Tea Party movement back in the 2010s, on the anti-abortion movement. She's basically a conservative commentator who has some interesting and, how should I put this lightly, forceful and distasteful views on a number of issues, including abortion. And also, you know, she believes that the United States is a Christian country, that evolution is bogus, and that abortion rights are an affront to decency.
Yeah.
She has some very interesting views on immigration.
Yeah, the funny thing about it is she, now remembering, she used to date Dinesh D'Souza.
Yes.
Who's also Indian.
Yes.
So she would date a dude who's Indian.
But not vote for him.
But not vote for president.
You are correct.
It's just hilarious.
I'm not racist, but I just don't think you have... your people have it in you to be president.
And I would know because I dated one of you.
I dated one. I mean, look, she's so conservative. She protested and she took issue with George W. Bush's immigration policy. Which is saying something. Of course, it's not as extreme as Trump's policy, but at the time, it was pretty conservative.
And she was also criticizing Trump for his immigration policy.
Absolutely. I think primarily because he didn't follow through with,
building the wall fast or quickly as beautifully as she wanted.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. So, yeah. What did you feel? How did you feel about it?
It reminded me of the scorpion and the frog story, right? Of all of the frogs telling this one frog, like, hey, don't be friends with a scorpion. It isn't going to work out for you. And he was like, well, look, the scorpion looks friendly enough. Like, the stinger isn't even up. But it's like, yeah, but it has a stinger. Scorpions are going to do what scorpions do, and that stinger is going to go up at some point, and it's going to sting you. The frog goes, well, I don't know. I think you guys are just fear-mongering. You guys don't know what you're talking about. How many scorpions do you actually know? The story ends with there's a flood one day, and then the scorpion goes to his quote-unquote friend, the frog, and says, hey, I need to get across this island or whatever we're standing
on. This primary.
Yeah, this primary, and we need to get across the river. Can I ride on your back? And the frog says, sure. And all the other frogs say, don't do it, man. I swear to God, you are going to die. The frog said, I hate this fear-mongering that you guys are doing. I'm going to help my friend, the scorpion, out. And they're swimming across the river, and sure enough, the scorpion stings the frog. And the frog asks, why? And the scorpion's like, I'm a scorpion. That's what I'm going to do. And they both drown.
Yeah. Well, nobody's drowning here. I was just thinking, I actually discussed this with you before the show. How would you have felt if instead of she's saying, I didn't vote for you because you're Indian, she said, I didn't vote for you because you're Tamil? And I guess our next theme is more in that line. Not necessarily Tamil, but, more about, I guess, Dravidian and South Indian nationalism. Do you want to kind of tee that up?
Absolutely. So for some context, I was born and raised in South India. The city that I spent most of my life in growing up was the city of Bangalore, which is in the Indian state of Karnataka in South India. And the language that we speak there is Kannada. And in the past, say, 20 years, there's been a lot of migration from North India, to South India. North India is where predominantly Hindi-speaking people live. There's obviously been conflict, right, of what language should you speak. And it's actually not alien to the Canadian population of when you're in Quebec, what language are you legally allowed to speak and what language are you expected to speak, right?
Yeah.
This is a clip where this issue kind of came to a head and there were two actors in the Kannada film industry in Bangalore, in Karnataka, which is the native language of the state is Kannada, and they were having dinner, and I'm going to let this man just quickly explain what happened to him and his wife after dinner.
My own city, I've been born and brought up here, and right now I've come to a situation where I need to think and do anything in the city. Before I go anywhere, I need to think twice if I can actually go to this place. It came to, why are you talking Kannada in our area? You can't talk Kannada in my area. Give an image, give a message that, you're a local Kannadiga, you cannot come to my area, and you cannot talk back to us. I think that's what kind of image they wanted to give.
I don't know if Kannada was the trigger point or I don't know what happened. Bangalore has the best, safety.
That was this gentleman describing what happened to him and his wife after dinner. So they step out of the restaurant and they were trying to retrieve their car, I believe, and there was another car kind of blocking their path. And so they said, "Could you move the car so we can get out?" And the other man took offense to it, and he said, "You can't say this to me in Kannada. In this area we speak Hindi, and this is in Bangalore where the native language is Kannada. This is like me going to any one of us going to Quebec City." Having a disagreement with somebody, right? And then saying, in this area, we only speak English. And then getting 20 or 30 people together and then beating them up for speaking French.
And that's what happened. There was 20, 30 people got together and
then beat the gentleman and his wife up for for speaking Kannada in Bangalore. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I found this very interesting because I think this is something that we talk about India and the Indian election and stuff on the show. But I think this issue in particular probably resonates with more Canadians than any other issue does.
Yeah.
Because this conflict of languages is something that's not new in India, but it's definitely coming to a head now.
Language, well, even with Modi's election, you know, he is a very effective communicator in Hindi, not so much in English, which is kind of sets him apart from previous Indian prime ministers, a lot of whom were very effective English, starting with Nehru himself.
Exactly.
You know, very effective English communicators, right?
Yeah. In fact, Nehru's speech at the stroke of midnight was in English.
Yeah.
That was a speech that ushered in New India. It was in English. It wasn't in Hindi.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So, yeah, it is fascinating, the language politics. And that kind of broke apart the opposition. We discussed it previously. That broken apart the opposition kind of coalition as well, where, you know, Nitish Kumar comes from a Hindi-speaking area, said, we need the prime minister to be Hindi-speaking. And, the president of Congress, who comes from, comes from Karnataka?
Yeah. Malikarjuna Khadge,
Which is, you know, the not a Hindi-speaking part of India, said, no, it's okay if, you know, they speak English. And that was kind of what made Nitish Kumar ultimately, leave the coalition. Besides other things, all sorts of other things, he wanted to be the prime ministerial candidate. But at the face of it, you know, that was the political issue. That was political football.
That drove him away, so to speak. Yeah.
Hypothetically drove him away. The other thing I want to clarify. Yeah. So there is this element of South Indian unity and nationalism, right? But there are different languages within South India, right? Like, so I was talking earlier about Tamil, and that's your...
My mother tongue,
Your mother tongue. But you grew up in this other part of South India where they speak a different language. But you still have this collective brotherhood of South Indian nationalism.
Yeah. Oh, and don't get me wrong. We fight amongst ourselves a lot, especially over issues like water, actually primarily water. But there's... And also language issues, right, that exist. But it's the... But when it comes down to, is it going to be Tamil or Kannada or Telugu or Hindi, then I think people very quickly fall in line and say, it can be any of these.
English.
English. It can be English. It can be any of these. It can't be Hindi.
Yeah.
Right?
Okay, super quick. We got a minute left. What's happening with the Canucks versus the Oilers? Okay, I don't know anything about hockey. Explain to me like I'm an idiot.
So the NHL playoffs are happening right now eventually. So these teams will, these playoffs are to decide who will play for the Stanley Cup, which is the trophy in the NHL. Tonight is game 6 of round 2 of the playoffs between the Vancouver Canucks and the Edmonton Oilers. It's happening in Edmonton tonight. If the Canucks win this, they will win the series 4-2, and they will go on to the conference final, the Western Conference final, to face the Dallas Stars.
I see. And then from the Western Conference final,
you go to the Stanley Cup finals.
Okay, so this is all leading up to the Stanley Cup.
It's all leading up to the Stanley Cup, absolutely.
Okay, awesome. Okay, now I understand. Everything makes sense.
So that's that. Go Canucks, go.
Okay, awesome. So a few other things to wrap up, I guess. You can find us at The Armonicle on Instagram and Twitter, so check us out there. The music you hear is by the wonderful, amazing,
incredibly talented,
unbelievably amazing Sarah Pratt, who makes the music for the show. The one we play is called Song of the Mies.
Just one other thing. We are on Spotify, so please do leave us a review on Spotify if you like what you heard.
And even if you don't like what you heard.
Yeah, please leave us a review anyway.
But make it positive.
Yes.
Positive review.
We do have some awesome shows with a set of guests lined up for you. Do continue to listen and subscribe. You can find all of our episodes on our podcast feeds. Do check them out. Thank you, and have a good night.